Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I am your host, Dwayne Mancini. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. You can always follow us on LinkedIn for more great content or go to our webpage, www.projectmedtech.com. You can also contact the podcast at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. My guests today are Veer Cohen and Dr. Jan Bakkenlot. Veer is the CEO of the medical device company Memic, and Dr. Jan is a gynecologist who has experience in innovative robotic systems. In this episode of the podcast, Veer, Jan, and myself discuss Memic, robotic surgery, how to evaluate an unmet clinical need, how they chose their first market, fundraising tips, and more. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Jan and Veer.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Veer, Jan, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for the invitation. Wonderful. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned both your bios, a little bit of your background. But let's start, well, Veer, we'll start with you and then we'll move to Jan. If you just want to give the listeners a brief introduction to who you are, your background in the space, and then we'll dive in.
Wonderful, thank you. So I'm Veer, the CEO and co-founder of the company. I've been for many years in the Israeli Ministry of Defense to develop fun robotic solutions with sub-micro accuracy, articulated instrumentations. And in course of duty, I met with a professor that had a very nice idea of developing robotic systems that had fingers so surgeons will better understand how to grasp different tissues. Back then it was the early days of robotic technology with all the complications on the bulky and cumbersome systems and lack of user interface. So he thought having a humanoid shape will make it easier for the surgeons. And actually I started to landscape the field of surgical robotics and I saw that it's the cutting edge technology. It's absolutely the best in class today. But eventually it points straight sticks in the abdomen in the same way that you can do without the surgical robotics. And I thought it must be a different way to do that. And I started to talk to different surgeons in gynecology, urology, general surgeons, ENT, and all of them really liked the idea of having a miniaturized humanoid inside the abdomen, but they've iterated, they don't use fingers during surgery, they use forceps and graspers. So I kept that idea in mind to develop a robotic system that have the entire upper extremity, shoulder, elbow, and wrist, with the entire degrees of freedom of 360 degrees of rotation articulation. And I've decided to be laser focused as a starting point on specific indications, which we are the only one that can facilitate. I'm sure you realize later in this call why we decided to focus on the field of gynecology and more specifically transvaginal approach for those indications.
Okay, great. And Jan, your background?
Yes, hi, Joanne. So my name is Jan Bakkenlot. I'm a gynecologist in Belgium. I work in Bonaire, and it's a medium-sized hospital in Belgium. I subspecialize in gyne-oncology, that's gynecological cancer surgery and minimally invasive surgery. The focus on my research the last couple of years has mainly been on transvaginal minimally access surgery, because we still know that the least invasive route to access the abdominal cavity for surgery is via natural orifice, via the vagina. So I wrote my PhD on vaginal access minimally invasive surgery, and part of that was on the start of robotic surgery and whether it would be feasible to operate transvaginally robotically. So after a while, I got into contact with Dvir and with Memic, and then we did the first clinical trials with the Memic hominis system for transvaginal endoscopic robotic surgery.
Wonderful. So I appreciate both your backgrounds and you guys both leading into my next question is talk to me about, you know, how you founded the company, you know, a little bit about the product. And then we'll continue to move on from there.
Wonderful. The idea of founding the company was about starting with identifying the unmet need, understanding how robotic technology can enable and provide the ability to do surgical procedures in a different way. Not just having more precise movement and more accurate movement, but leveraging the benefit of robotics to do something entirely different. And with that idea of the finger type solution and the humanoid shape and proportions, we really invested a lot of our time at the foundation of the company to understand where will be our first indications and how we can really fulfill an unmet clinical need to provide and enable the surgeon to do surgeries otherwise. And in one of the statements by the ACOG, the American College of Gynecologists, stating that a vaginal approach to hysterectomy should be performed whenever feasible. And I've asked one of those surgeons that have started the discussions, what do you mean whenever feasible? If that's the approach of choice, why won't you do it in all of your cases? And he's starting to explain that there are some very severe anatomical restrictions that are restricting the accessibility for the better solution of transvaginal for the vast majority of patients. And I thought, this is exactly the purpose of robotics. The purpose of robotics is to bring new tools, new instruments that changes the game and providing the surgeons with more capabilities. And this is how, when I started, I was wanted to analyze the market, understand what everyone are doing, what's currently robotic technology is, and I've actually landscape the entire field, even universities and large strategic players to see what they're thinking about surgical robotics. And this is how we found our angle and bringing something entirely different to the market.
Okay, wonderful. And then how did you get in contact with Jan?
So I think eventually I looked for the right partner to share the dream of enabling transvaginal access for the vast majority of patients. Mm-hmm. And when I saw the academic wonderful work that Jan did in many publications, I knew that we found the right partners. And when I tried to explain, I sent him some emails, picked up the phone and called him and tried to explain, we have a very disruptive idea of going transvaginally and retroflex through the point of entry with our unique robotic instrumentations to allow marrying the benefits of transvaginal and laparoscopic approach. And he just stopped me and said, I totally understand what you're doing. You don't need to explain to me what the point of entry is and what are the benefits of transvaginal and how what that retroflexion capabilities can provide, because this is absolutely my vision as well. And I'm sure that we can find the best collaboration out there. Just send whatever you can. I'll be happy to see the technology. So I think the following week, I already packed the system. The system is very small and compact, which is very, very mobile. So I was able to take the entire system with a carry-on. I flew to Belgium, unpacked him in his office. And that was the beginning of a fascinating journey.
Wonderful. And Jan, I'd love to hear from a physician standpoint. I think Vera did a great job of summarizing the unmet need, but just from a physician standpoint, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it really started with a phone call from Vera, and I was immediately triggered by the idea, and I couldn't believe actually that they were this far with the idea already and that they had the vision to develop this sort of, you know, a couple of years before that they started. Because at the time, maybe I must just take you back about the roots of hysterectomy to give a little bit of background.
Yeah.
The longest existing hysterectomy, more than 200 years already, is the vaginal hysterectomy, the conventional vaginal hysterectomy. And then 50 years later, an abdominal hysterectomy was developed. We are talking also 150 years ago, which was by an incision through the abdominal wall. And those two were sort of the two dominant routes of hysterectomy for many, many years. Then in the 1980s, 1990s, laparoscopy or keyhole surgery came in, where surgeons actually did those abdominal operations, but only through three or four small incisions in the abdomen. And that was a great disruptor because that made it a far less minimally invasive, and the patient recovered quicker, they had less scars, and they recovered quicker compared to the abdominal hysterectomy. At the same time, the vaginal hysterectomy stayed and was still done alongside of the laparoscopic hysterectomy. Then in the years 2000, we saw an evolution of this four-incision laparoscopic hysterectomy into what they call the single-site hysterectomy or single-site surgery, where surgeons only make one incision in the abdominal wall and did the hysterectomy that way to reduce the invasiveness even more, because the goal of every surgery or evolution in surgery should be to reduce the invasiveness. After that, a lot of the work I did was on V-node surgery, which is called vaginal natural orifice translumeninoscopic surgery, which is a mouthful actually to say that you're doing that endoscopic surgery through the vagina without any abdominal incisions at all. At the same time, we've been seeing an evolution into robotic transabdominal surgery and hysterectomy, which is like the laparoscopic hysterectomy, the straight stick through the four incisions, but then performed with a robot, a bulkier robot that's inserted through the abdominal wall, and where the procedure is actually guided by a surgeon who's sitting remotely, not standing bedside next to the patient. But at the same time, this vaginal hysterectomy that's been around for more than 200 years stayed. And it's still, as Dvir said, ACOG, despite all the other minimally invasive techniques that are out there, still says that the vaginal hysterectomy, it should be the preferred route whenever feasible, because the evidence still says that it's the least invasive approach. Now, my idea always was that these three evolutions that are parallel, you have the vaginal hysterectomy, and then you have the abdominal that eventually evolved towards single site and V-nodes and the robotics, would merge together in a transvaginal robotic surgery in the long term, I always thought, because technology wasn't there yet. And then I got into contact with Vir, and then turned out that they'd been working on that technology for a couple of years already. So of course I was very interested in doing the clinical trials for them, because that's sort of, you know, where the long-term vision of where hysterectomy was going to go was headed.
Okay, great. And I, you know, you brought up a really good point, and I talk about this in the podcast a lot, is being a historian of the unmet clinical need. And that's exactly what you guys did, right? That's exactly what you just described. Was, I think a lot of times people focus on an unmet clinical need, and then they focus on, okay, how do we solve this, rather than learning about, yeah, what was the unmet clinical need, but how was it solved in the past? And this is a really good example of you taking something that has been around for a long time and just revolutionizing it and pulling it forward and really taking your own spin on it. So I think it's really fascinating, and it's a really good lesson that listeners can take, not just from your specific problem, but they can apply this in other unmet clinical needs. So I think it's really cool. I really appreciate the background. Can you guys talk a little bit about, you know, the product, what's the name? And I also understand that you had some pretty exciting news recently, correct? In terms of the US market?
Absolutely. So I'll start with the product. The name of the product is Hominis, which is humanoid in Latin, which is exactly the idea of mimicking the surgeon movements and shoulder, elbow, and wrist. And that product with that very, very unique structure, number one, allows the surgeon to reach regions that are non-feasible today, and allowing the surgeon to understand, because it's actually mimicking his movements. Mm-hmm. And we just recently received our FDA marketing authorizations that allows us to start commercializing our technology in the States. And this is a tremendous achievement. And we've collaborated significantly with the FDA. We had a very fruitful discussion in the last couple of years. And when we showed this technology to the FDA, and we worked together with them on different pre-submission meetings, and when they saw this technology, they said, it's a new technology. I cannot compare your fascinating instrumentations to anything out there currently in the market. And it's a very unique approach. I cannot find a legally marketed device aimed for transvaginal access. And that's why FDA classified us as a de novo. That means that what the FDA told us, that they cannot find a predicate device for our technology and approach. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we were able to collaborate with the agency, with the FDA, to receive that marketing authorization, it's a significant achievement for our company, which is based both in Israel, right next to Tel Aviv, and where we have our US headquarters in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, that we have all of the professional education, sales, marketing, customer operation, and professional education is there. And this is a wonderful achievement for the entire team to be able to bring this product to the market.
Yeah, and are you approved in other areas, or this is the US is the first region?
United States is the first region that will get our approval, expecting approval in other regions later this year.
Okay, great. So I want to come back to that on why US, why FDA, you know, how you handled the de novo pathway, because I think a lot of these are going to be questions that other entrepreneurs, other device companies have. But before we get there, I do want to discuss a little bit about, so the clinical trial was run. Jan, I assume you were taking the lead there. Can you just give us, you know, talk to us a little bit about how that went, the success, how it was using the device? Is it easy? You know, I think some things like that I'm always curious about. And also, you know, what kind of endpoints you designed your clinical trial around?
I'll just say about the use of the device. Of course, it was a completely new device. So there's a learning curve to every new technique. But what we found was that the learning curve to work with it was very short. And interesting in the study was that, you know, on Sundays, we did three hysterectomies on the same day in the study. And you could see that the surgical time for the third procedure was significantly shorter than for the second and the first procedure. So it got shorter and shorter, sort of indicating that, you know, you quickly learn to work with the system. It's different to other robotic system because I had experience with other robotic systems, and it's a different way to work with it. One of my fellows did a couple of cases as well, and she had no experience in robotic surgery at all. And she did four cases, and to be honest, her fourth case, she did faster and smoother than I did my other cases. So, you know, you really learn to work quickly and easily with the system.
Okay.
Maybe quickly as an introduction on the trial, and then Vir can continue with it. It's actually two studies that were done, one on hysterectomy, the removal of the uterus, and one on adnexectomy, the removal of ovaries and fallopian tubes. Both studies were done multi-center, so they were, for the hysterectomy study, most patients were included in my hospital in Bonaerden, and other patients were included in Prague and in Haifa with Professor Loewenstein. And for the adnexectomy study, it was vice versa. Most patients were included with Professor Loewenstein in Haifa, and we included in Bonaerden as well. I think one of the important features to show in the study was that the procedure can be performed in different anatomical settings, not just in a straightforward easy hysterectomy that you could do in other ways as well. And there we could see a nice variability of the patients, where there were smaller uteri and larger uteri, some patients with adhesions, some patients with endometriosis, which is a condition that typically makes surgery more complicated, in skinny patients, in more obese patients, in younger patients, in older patients. So I think it showed a good variability of that you can use the system in any different situation.
Yeah, you know, let me ask a question there, because I think this is something that we try to stress to clients when they're designing clinical trials. A lot of times it's, you know, hey, we need to make sure in our clinical trial we address whatever the regulatory agencies need, right? And obviously that's a no-brainer, makes total sense. But there's always other pillars involved, right? What you need to do to get reimbursement, especially in a complicated reimbursement system like the US, right? Reimbursement in other areas isn't as difficult, but in the US, it's a complex system. So you need to be prepared for that, right? And make sure you're collecting those endpoints. But another one that I'm maybe not as familiar with, but I know it's important, and it sounds like you address that, especially coming from, you know, the end user, is designing it around not just FDA and reimbursement, or EU, wherever you're going, but also usability, right? Being able to collect those endpoints to go to other physicians or other end users and say, hey, this is, you know, we used it on, like you mentioned, right? Right. Different body sizes. And that's important for an end user, but something for me in my regulatory reimbursement mind that I wouldn't even be thinking about, but it's only something you can gather as an end user. So I think that's a really good lesson that you highlighted on there. The importance of collecting that data to be able to sell this product, after you have approval. So really, really interesting. Veer, I don't know, do you have anything to add to this?
Yes, absolutely. That was the exact reason. That was the purpose of the clinical studies eventually. If you think about the core idea, miniaturizing the surgeon and in placing him inside the abdominal or pelvic cavity to do those procedures, those surgical tasks, the basic idea is, and that's the first indication, which is transvaginal approach to various gynecological indications, but the idea that the vaginal access is underutilized today, although it's a better approach for the patients and for the healthcare system, it's underutilized today. And the idea was that with our technology, we can broaden the feasibility of transvaginal access. Mm-hmm. So the number one purpose of the study was exactly that, to validate the offering of this technology that currently, for example, adhesions cannot be done in a transvaginal access. So we wanted to collect the data to show that we can conduct those procedures under femi to fibrotic and vascular adhesions or endometriosis or size of the uterus, which is sometimes an exclusion criteria for transvaginal access, or the level of prolapse. All of these criteria, we build maps on verifying the patient population and variability. And that was exactly the purpose of the study. You asked earlier about the endpoints. We wanted to show and to demonstrate that we can do exactly what I've noted earlier, to leverage this technology to enable surgical procedures such as transvaginal access in different pathologies that are currently off limit to other instruments.
Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, how is this reducing the cost for patient healthcare systems, whatever it may be?
Yeah, so that's one of the very, very important pieces of the puzzle that we wanted to solve early on when we thought about the basic fundamental design of the system, and we'll get to that later. But the idea of, as Dr. Bakalan explained earlier, that surgical procedure are being done today with straight sticks instrument through puncture wounds in the abdomen, controlled by straight sticks. And that's something that it's not as easy to maneuver. And having robotic technology, if you want to control a straight stick instrument, you need that to position the instruments. And in surgeries, you eventually just need to position your grasper to conduct the surgical task and advanced instrumentations. But if the position technology in today's robotics is based on leveraging the motion of the motors outside of the patient and controlling sticks in the abdomen, in order to have submillimetric movement of accuracy, I need to be very, very precise outside of the patient. And therefore, the systems are bulky and therefore they are expensive. And the fact that we don't use sophisticated motors and bulky system to position the straight stick instruments, we mimicking the surgeon arms and in placing the entire position technology inside the patient with a very sophisticated instrumentations. And therefore the capital equipment is a fraction of the size, and therefore it's a fraction of the cost. So actually I can hold the entire robotic control unit with my bare hands. And the fact that the system is so small allows us to have it table mounted. That has a very large clinical implication as well. And Dr. Buckland can explain about it later, but the basic architecture of the system that's replacing large robotic system that controls straight six instruments into humanoid shaped instruments with a very small and elegant robotic control unit at a small cost, small footprint, and easy to use, lowers the economical consideration of using robotic technology significantly.
Okay, good. Okay, so.
And yeah, actually I do want to add that in every case that we did, I've always insisted to take the smallest room in the hospital. And in some cases, I even took the ambulatory surgery settings in Israel. And when I went to Dr. Bakaland and asked him to use the room that is the smallest one in the hospital, he told me, but we have a robotics room around the, well, down the hall. That says, we don't use that room, room number 10, if I remember. We don't use room number 10 and for the surgical robotic system. That's the smallest room that we keep that technological room down the hall. And I told him, no, you need to see our system. That's exactly what we want to do, because we want to demonstrate that we can fit into rooms and into surgical economical consideration that are off bounds today.
Right. And that's not just a cost issue. That's a practicality issue in every OR in around the world, is that if you have a small system that you can move around between ORs and you don't have to build an OR room around the robot, that makes a really big difference to the end user, of course.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, great. Okay, so I finally want to get to the question of why the US, you know, what made you choose FDA first? And then also the de novo pathway, because this is something that, something we harp on a lot here at the podcast, but just when we talk to clients in general, is sometimes the easiest, you know, path to market is not, from a regulatory standpoint, is not always the best from a business standpoint. And people always, is a classic example of de novo versus 510K, a traditional 510K. And a lot of people get scared away by de novo because it typically means you need a clinical trial. It's more expensive. However, it does set you apart once you get, if you can get that market authorization. So tell me a little bit about, you know, when you heard de novo, were you scared, or did that say, yeah, that's exactly what we want, because it means that there's no predicate, we're a market disruptor. You know, it kind of gives you that stamp. So just take me through that process. You know, US, why US FDA, why de novo, the strategy you used behind it, and whatnot.
Wonderful. So I'll start by explaining that this is a disruptive technology. This is something entirely different from other robotic technologies.
Right.
And we understand that we wanted to collaborate with the agency, with the FDA, to understand the requirements to bring this technology to the market. And because it's fulfilled the unmet needs of, that is stated by the societies, the insurance companies, that vaginal approach is the approach of choice whenever feasible, we were able to communicate and collaborate with the FDA, with the agency, to build the right pathway for this technology. So eventually when they noticed that we are de novo, and we know that down the road, other robotic players will need to be a de novo, classified under a de novo as well, we are the first to the market in a de novo. And I think it validates how important this technology as the first ever robotic technology that enable transvaginal access for a variety of gynecological indications. And the fact that it's a de novo, that means that on top of the high technological bar that we set and a very strong IP bar that we set, that we've covered our technology and the actual surgical procedures that are enabled by this technology are also IP protected. The fact that we have a regulatory bar as well by the de novo classification process, this is something which is absolutely valuable for the company. Mm-hmm. And we're able to achieve that tremendous achievement by the first, being the first ever robotic technology that allows those surgical procedures. We were able to do that by an incredible work of the entire team and very strong collaboration with the FDA.
Wonderful. So that's very helpful. The other piece to this, right? So immediately, if you have a de novo, it requires more money to get to market, right? And obviously, your team was successful with that. So you must have been successful in fundraising. And that is always a hot topic when talking to startup companies, is not only the simple one of, you know, how to find money, do you have tips for fundraising? But I think some of the other ones are finding smart money, raising not too little, but not too much during various series of raises. So you have some tips for startup companies that are in the fundraising process?
Oh, I think, yes, it's always a very important piece of the puzzle to have the right capital to fulfill the goals of the company. But I feel that raising money, that's one thing, but the smart thing to do is to raise the right partner with you. And I think we were very fortunate to work with very, very strong founders and partners since the early beginning, since the technological incubator through a different series of investment in the company. And our investors and partners worked so closely with us that they actually were part of the team when we flew for our first clinical cases. They were there with us. They were part of the team, both on the early days of understanding the business, making sure that the strategy of the business is aligned to the strategy of what the market needs are. And we're very differentiated from other solutions as well. And to build both short-term and long-term strategy. And that's something that, of course, it's always very important to have the right people around the table to brainstorm on the clinical implication, business implication, regulatory implications. And that's something which is crucial for the success of the company. And it's fascinating to know that eventually the important decision, the really, really make or break decisions of every company are usually taken at the earlier stages. When I had the idea of humanoid and shoulder, elbow, and wrist, and having an entirely different platform, different configuration, I sat with the board members and we did an exercise of defining the risk appetite from different aspects on the controls, on the robotic controlling and the instrumentations. And I've told them that I want to set together with them the expectation on our, the company's risk appetite for different elements of the system where we want to be really disruptive. And we all agree that when I had a vision of the instrumentation, that's where we want to be unique. Eventually, that's what we've decided to do. And that decision that we took on the first board meeting eventually led us to this day.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Good to hear. Jan, do you have anything to add to this? I know this might not be the area of expertise for you, but
yeah. No, it's not my area of expertise at all. I also, like, I wasn't involved in the development of the robot, so I can't take any credit for any of that. I stepped in a lot later and I was, you know, I did the clinical trial and I'm the end user. So I think the one thing that I've observed, and it's maybe to the side of the question, but since the podcast is for, you know, for people who are starting businesses and tips and tricks, the one thing I've noticed watching Dvir in the last couple of years is that nobody works harder than Dvir. And the man works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He's always available. He's always there. And I think, you know, the part of the success is just really, really hard, long work. And I think that's just part for everybody. That's what I can see from an outside observer.
Yeah, I think it's good advice. I mean, it's something that I think I just a couple weeks ago posted a video about. I had a guest on, Dr. Brandy Baldwin, who's kind of a coach for entrepreneurs in a way, and she just talked about, you know, being all in, and to truly be all in. I think some people think they're all in on some specific aspect of what they're doing, but truly buying in and giving it your all is a big deal. So I think it's great to hear that, you know, there's a lot of work that goes behind getting a product to market. You know, it's not easy, especially in the medical device space. When you do, I'm sure it's incredibly rewarding. So, you know, kudos to both of you. Okay, that covered a lot of my questions I had. I do want to ask one more for each of you. And that is, you have one piece of advice, and I think, Jan, you might have just given it, but I'll still ask it again. One piece of advice to entrepreneurs, innovators, scientists, whoever it may be, they're looking at a product, they're about to spin off their first company, they want to go through, you know, try to get it to market. What's your one piece of advice you'd give to them?
Okay, so maybe I'll start and I'll maybe bring it into two parts.
Yeah.
I think the one is think of the end user, because it's, you might get to a stage and get an FDA approval and approval to sell it. But if your end user doesn't have the need and doesn't, you know, advance with it, you're going to struggle to sell it. And then the second bit's what I just said, you know, just be prepared to work long and hard and go for it full in, as you said.
Right. Beer?
Well, I believe that in everything I do and the company is doing eventually, it's better to flow words, innovation, people, processes, and reaching the unreachable. That's what we believe. Innovation is just the starting point. You need to find the right people to be around you that share your vision, that everyone can contribute a tremendous achievement to the table to understand, to make the wise decision at the right time. And after you recruit the right people that are really the founding members and your partners, you want to build the processes to build a successful business. And if you do that properly, you can really reach the unreachable.
Awesome. Listen, I appreciate both your time today. Hang on the line for 1 second. We'll do a quick discussion offline. But I think what you guys are doing is great. You have congratulations on being approved in the US. Congratulations on the product. I think you guys gave a lot of great advice for companies who are getting into medical device development. There's a lot of key takeaways that they can take from your success and apply to their company as well. So really appreciate your time. Hold on for 1 second and we'll have a quick discussion offline.
Wonderful. Thank you, Joy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.